This is merely a personal narrative, and not a pretentious history or a philosophical dissertation. It is a record of several years of variegated vagabondizing. Still, there is information concerning an interesting episode in the history of the Far West, about which no books have been written by persons who were on the ground in person and saw the happenings of the time with their own eyes. Yes, take it all around, there is a good deal of information. I regret this very much, but it really could not be helped. Information appears to stew up out of me naturally. Sometimes it has seemed to me that I would give worlds if I could retain my facts, but it cannot be. The more I cock up the sources, the tighter I get, the more I leak wisdom. Therefore, I claim indulgence at your hands, not justification. My brother had just been appointed Secretary of Nevada Territory. Ooh, an office of such majesty that it concentrated in itself the duties and dignities of Treasurer, Comptroller, Secretary of State, and Acting Governor in the Governor's absence. A salary of $1,800 a year and the title of Mr. Secretary gave to the great position an air of wild and imposing grandeur. I was young and ignorant, and I envied my brother. I coveted his distinction and his financial splendor, but particularly and especially the long, strange journey he was going to make, and the curious new world he was going to explore. He was going to travel. I had never been away from home, and that word travel had a seductive charm for me. Pretty soon he'd be hundreds and hundreds of miles away on the great plains and deserts, and among the mountains of the Far West, and you'd see buffaloes and Indians and prairie dogs and antelopes, and have all kinds of adventures, and maybe get hanged or scalped, and have ever such a fine time, and write home and tell us all about it and be a hero. And he would see the gold mines and the silver mines, and maybe go about of an afternoon when his work was done, and pick up two or three pails full of shining slugs and nuggets of gold and silver on the hillside, and by... he would become very rich and return home by sea and be able to talk as calmly about San Francisco and the ocean and the isthmus as if it was nothing of any consequence to have seen those marvels face to face. What I suffered in contemplating his happiness, pen cannot describe. And so, when he offered me in cold blood the sublime position of private secretary under him, it appeared to me that the heavens and the earth passed away, and the firmament was rolled together as a scroll. I had nothing more to desire. My contentment was complete. At the end of an hour or two, I was ready for the journey. Not much packing up was necessary, because we were going in the overland stage from the Missouri frontier to Nevada, and passengers were only allowed a small quantity of baggage apiece. There was no Pacific Railroad in those fine times, not a single rail of it. I only proposed to stay in Nevada 3 months. I had no thought of staying longer than that. I meant to see all that I could that was new and strange, and then hurry home to business. I little thought that I would not see the end of that 3 month pleasure excursion for 6 or 7 uncommonly long years. I dreamed all night about Indians and deserts and silver bars, and in due time next day we took shipping at the St. Louis Wharf on board a steamboat bound up the Missouri River. We were 6 days going from St. Louis to St. Joe. The first thing we did on that glad evening that landed us at St. Joseph was to hunt up the stage office and pay $150 apiece for tickets per overland coach to Carson City, Nevada. The next morning, bright and early, we took a hasty breakfast and hurried to the starting place. Then an inconvenience presented itself which we had not properly appreciated before, namely that one cannot make a heavy traveling trunk stand for 25 pounds of baggage, because it weighs a good deal more. But that was all we could take, 25 pounds each, so we had to snatch our trunks open and make a selection in a good deal of a hurry. We put our lawful 25 pounds apiece all in one valise and shipped the trunks back to St. Louis again. Just beyond the breakfast station, we overtook a Mormon immigrant train of 33 wagons, and tramping wearily along and driving their herd of loose cows were dozens of coarse-clad and sad-looking men, women, and children who had walked as they were walking now, day after day, for 8 lingering weeks, and in that time had compassed the distance our stage had come in 8 days and 3 hours, 798 miles. They were dusty and uncombed, hatless, bonnetless, and ragged, and they did look so tired. We hurried on to the home of the Latter-day Saints, the stronghold of the prophets, the capital of the only absolute monarch in America, Great Salt Lake City. As the night closed, we took sanctuary in the Salt Lake House and unpacked our baggage. We had a fine supper of the freshest meats and fowls and vegetables, a great variety, and as great abundance. We walked about the streets some afterward and glanced in at shops and stores, and there was assignation in surreptitiously staring at every creature we took to be a Mormon. This was a fairyland to us, to all intents and purposes, a land of enchantment and goblins and awful mystery. We felt a curiosity to ask every child how many mothers it had, and if it could tell them apart. Oh, and we experienced a thrill every time a dwelling house door opened and shut as we passed, disclosing a glimpse of human heads and backs and shoulders, for we so longed to have a good, satisfying look at a Mormon family in all its comprehensive ampleness, disposed in the customary concentric rings of its home circle. By and by, the acting governor of the territory introduced us to other Gentiles, and we spent a sociable hour with them. Gentiles are people who are not Mormons. Next day, we strolled about everywhere, through the broad, straight, level streets, and enjoyed the pleasant strangeness of a city of 15,000 inhabitants with no loafers perceptible in it. No visible drunkards or noisy people. A limpid stream rippling and dancing through every street in place of a filthy gutter. Block after block of trim dwellings built of frame and sunburned brick. A great thriving orchard and garden behind every one of them, apparently. Branches from the street stream winding and sparkling among the garden beds and fruit trees, and a grand general air of neatness, repair, thrift, and comfort around and about and over the whole. And everywhere were workshops, factories, and all manner of industries. And intent faces and busy hands were to be seen wherever one looked, and in one's ears was the ceaseless clink of hammers, the buzz of trade, and the contented hum of drums and flywheels. The Mormon crest was easy, and it was simple, unostentatious, and fitted like a glove. It was a representation of a golden beehive, with all the bees at work. The city lies on the edge of a level plain as broad as the state of Connecticut, and crouches down close to the ground under the curving wall of mighty mountains whose heads are hidden in the clouds, and whose shoulders bear relics of the snows all winter long. Seen from one of these dizzying heights, 12 or 15 miles off, Great Salt Lake City is toned down and diminished till it is suggestive of a child's tour village reposing under the majestic protection of the Chinese Wall. On some of these mountains to the southwest, it had been raining every day for 2 weeks, but not a drop had fallen in the city. And on hot days in late spring and early autumn, the citizens could quit fanning and growling and go out and cool off by looking at the luxury of a glorious snowstorm going on in the mountains. They could enjoy it at a distance. At those seasons, every day, though no snow would fall in their streets or anywhere near them. Salt Lake City was healthy. An extremely healthy city. Well, they declared there was only one physician in the place, and he was arrested every week, regularly, and held to answer under the Vagrant Act for having no visible means of support. They always give you a good substantial article of truth in Salt Lake, and good measure and good weight, too. Very often, if you wish to weigh one of their airiest little commonplace statements, you would want the hay scales. We desired to visit the famous inland sea, the American Dead Sea, the Great Salt Lake, 17 miles horseback from the city, for we had dreamed about it, and thought about it, and talked about it, and yearned to see it, all the first part of our trip, but now, when it was only arm's length away, it had suddenly lost nearly every bit of its interest. And so we put it off in a general way, till next day, and that was the last we ever thought of it. We dined with some hospitable Gentiles, and visited the foundation of the prodigious temple, and talked long with that shrewd Connecticut Yankee, Heber C. Kimball, since deceased, a saint of high degree, and a mighty man of commerce. We saw the tithing house and the lion house. I do not know or remember how many more church and government buildings of various kinds and curious names. We flitted hither and thither and enjoyed every hour, and picked up a great deal of useful information and entertaining nonsense, and went to bed at night satisfied. The second day, we put on white shirts and went and paid a state visit to the king. Well, he seemed a quiet, kindly, easy-mannered, dignified, self-possessed old gentleman of 55 or 60, and he had a gentle craft in his eyes that probably belonged there. He was very simply dressed and was just taking off a straw hat as we entered. He talked about Utah and was the Indians and Nevada, and with general American matters and questions, with our secretary and certain government officials who came with us, but He never paid any attention to me. Notwithstanding, I made several attempts to draw him out on federal politics and his high-handed attitude toward Congress. I thought some of the things I said were rather fine, but he merely looked round at me at distant intervals, something as I have seen a benignant old cat look around to see which kitten was meddling with her tail. By and by, I subsided into an indignant silence, and so sat until the end, hot and flushed, and execrating him in my heart for an ignorant savage. But he was calm. His conversation with those gentlemen flowed on as sweetly and peacefully and musically as any summer brook. Well, when the audience was ended and we were retiring from the presence, he put his hand on my head, beamed down on me in an admiring way, and said to my brother, "Ah, your child, I presume. Boy or girl?" Well, there is a batch of governors and judges and other officials here shipped from Washington, and they maintain the semblance of a Republican form of government, but the petrified truth is that Utah is an absolute monarchy and Brigham Young is king. Our stay in Salt Lake amounted to only 2 days, and therefore we had no time to make the customary inquisition into the workings of polygamy and get up the usual statistics and deductions preparatory to calling the attention of the nation at large once more to the matter. I had the will to do it. With the gushing self-sufficiency of youth, I was feverish to plunge in headlong and achieve a great reform here, until I saw the Mormon women. Then I was touched. My heart was wiser than my head. It warmed toward these poor, ungainly, and pathetically homely creatures. And as I turned to hide the generous moisture in my eyes, I said, "No! The man that marries one of them has done an act of Christian charity which entitles him to the kindly applause of mankind, not their harsh censure. And the man that marries 60 of them has done a deed of open-handed generosity so sublime that the nations should stand uncovered in his presence and worship in silence." It is a luscious country for thrilling evening stories about assassinations of intractable Gentiles. I cannot easily conceive of anything more cozy than the night in Salt Lake, which we spent in a Gentile den, smoking pipes and listening to tales of how Porter Rockwell did this and that dreadful thing, and how heedless people often come to Utah and make remarks about Brigham, or polygamy, or some other sacred matter, and the very next morning at daylight such parties are sure to be found lying up some back alley, contentedly waiting for the hearse. Oh, and the next most interesting thing is to sit and listen to these Gentiles talk about polygamy, and how some portly old frog of an elder or a bishop marries a girl, likes her, marries her sister, likes her, marries another sister, likes her, takes another, likes her, marries her mother, likes her, marries her father, grandfather, great-grandfather, then comes back hungry and asks for more. And how the pert young thing of 11 will chance to be the favorite wife, and her own venerable grandmother have to rank away down toward D4 in their mutual husband's esteem, and have to sleep in the kitchen as like as not. And how this dreadful sort of thing, this hiving together in one foul nest of mothers and daughters, and the making of the young goddess superior to her own mother in rank and authority, are things which Mormon women submit to because their religion teaches them that the more wives a man has on earth, and the more children he rears, the higher the place they will all have in the world to come, and the warmer maybe, though they do not seem to say anything about that. According to these Gentile friends of ours, Brigham Young's harem contains 20 or 30 wives. They said that some of them had grown old and gone out of active service, but they were comfortably housed and cared for in the hennery, or the lion house as it is strangely named. Along with each wife were her children, 50 altogether. The house was perfectly quiet and orderly when the children were still. They all took their meals in one room, and a happy and homelike sight it was pronounced to be. None of our party got an opportunity to take dinner with Mr. Young, but a Gentile by the name of Johnson professed to have enjoyed a sociable breakfast in the Lion House. He gave a preposterous account of the calling of the roll and other preliminaries and the carnage that ensued when the buckwheat cakes came in, but he embellished rather too much. At the end of our 2 days' sojourn, we left Great Salt Lake City, hearty and well-fed and happy, physically superb, but not so very much wiser as regards the Mormon question than when we arrived, perhaps. We had a deal more information than we had before, of course, but we did not know what portion of it was reliable, and what was not, for it all came from acquaintances of a day, strangers, strictly speaking, Well, all of our information had three sides to it, and so I gave up the idea that I could settle the Mormon question in 2 days. Still, I have seen newspaper correspondents do it in one. I left Great Salt Lake a good deal confused as to what state of things existed there, and sometimes even questioned in my own mind whether a state of things existed there or not. But presently, I remembered, with a lightning sense of relief, that we had learned two or three trivial things which we could be certain of, and so the 2 days were not wholly lost. For instance, we had learned that we were at last in a pioneer land, in absolute and tangible reality. Well, Mormonism was only about 40 years old, but its career has been full of stir and adventure from the beginning and is likely to remain so to the end. Its adherents have been hunted and hounded from one end of the country to the other, and the result is that for years they have hated all Gentiles, indiscriminately and with all their might. Joseph Smith, the founder of the Book of Mormon and founder of the religion, was driven from state to state with his mysterious copper plates and the miraculous stones he read their inscriptions with. Finally, he instituted his church in Ohio, and Brigham Young joined it. The neighbors began to persecute, and apostasy commenced. Brigham held to the faith and worked hard. He arrested desertion. He did more. He added converts in the midst of the trouble. He rose in favor and importance with the brethren. He was made one of the 12 apostles of the church. He shortly fought his way to a higher post and a more powerful president of the 12. The neighbors rose up and drove the Mormons out of Ohio, and they settled in Missouri. Brigham went with them. The Missourians drove them out, and they retreated to Nauvoo, Illinois, but the Mormons were badgered and harried again by their neighbors. The people of the neighborhood on both sides of the Mississippi claimed that polygamy was practiced by the Mormons, and not only polygamy, but a little bit of everything that was bad. Brigham returned from a mission to England where he had established a Mormon newspaper, and he brought back with him several hundred converts to his preaching. His influence among the brethren augmented with every move he made. Finally, Nauvoo was invaded by the Missouri and Illinois Gentiles, and Joseph Smith killed. The people straightway elected Brigham Young president by a prodigious majority and have never faltered in their devotion to him from that day to this. He recognized that it was better to move to the wilderness than be moved. By his command, the people gathered together their meager effects, turning their backs upon their homes, their faces towards the wilderness, and on a bitter night in February, filled with sorrowful possession, marched across the frozen Mississippi. Lighted on their way by the glare burning from their temple, whose sacred furniture their own hands had fired. Well, they camped several days afterward on the western verge of Iowa, and poverty, want, hunger, cold, sickness, grief, and persecution did their work, and many succumbed and died. Martyrs, fair and true, whatever else they might have been. 2 years the remnant remained here while Brigham and a small party crossed the country and founded Great Salt Lake City, purposely choosing a land which was outside the ownership and jurisdiction of the hated American nation. Note that. This was in 1847. Brigham moved his people there and got them settled just in time to see disaster fall again. For the war closed and Mexico ceded Brigham's refuge to the enemy, the United States. In 1849, the Mormons organized a free and independent government and erected the State of Deseret with Brigham Young as its head. But the very next year, Congress deliberately snubbed it and created the territory of Utah out of the same accumulation of mountains, sagebrush, alkali, and general desolation, but made Brigham governor of it. Then, for years, the enormous migration across the plains to California poured through the land of the Mormons, and yet the church remained staunch and true to its Lord and Master. Neither hunger, thirst, poverty, grief, hatred, contempt, nor persecution could drive the Mormons from their faith or their allegiance, and even the thirst for gold, which gleaned the flower of youth and strength of many nations, was not about to entice them. That was the final test. An experiment that could survive that was an experiment with some substance to it somewhere. Great Salt Lake City throve finally, and so did Utah. Up to the date of our visit to Utah, such had been the territorial record. The territorial government established there had been a hopeless failure. Brigham Young was the only real power in the land. Well, he was an absolute monarch, a monarch who defied our president, a monarch who laughed at our armies when they capped about his capital, and a monarch who received without emotion the news that the August Congress of the United States had enacted a solemn law against polygamy, and then went forth and calmly married 25 or 30 more wives.